This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from Cornwall, England, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
We're going to start today in Lebanon, where the French president made a historic visit that points not only to Lebanon's past, but it strongly indicates its future as foretold in biblical prophecy. Let's go straight to Brent Noctegal.
So we've talked about how French President Macron was the first international leader to be on the scene in Beirut after the explosion back on August 4th that ended up killing almost 200 people and causing a lot of damage to the whole city of Beirut. Well, he gave, in moving around the streets, really encouraging the people back then, he said he'll be back in a few weeks and that that date would be September 1st. And so he returned this past week on Monday and stayed there till Tuesday. And he was there encouraging the people. He also met with a number of popular Lebanese people that aren't necessarily part of the government, but trying to give support and show that he is trying to ensure that the money that comes in doesn't go to the leaders that have, or that the money could be used by the leaders that have ruled Lebanon for the past 30 or 40 years and to line their pockets. He believes that change, fundamental change, needs to happen to Lebanon in the wake of this massive explosion. And he's there on the scene to try and implement that. Before his arrival, he made sure that a number of changes were already made, and that is that there would be a caretaker prime minister brought in that isn't affiliated with any of the specific clans, and that caretaker prime minister will start to oversee the creation of a new government that will be able to put in serious reforms to how the government works, in order for it to receive lots of money from other states, including France, United States, Germany, a lot of others, so that they can rebuild Lebanon. And so he is really the point man in the restoration efforts for Beirut, but also the point man in transforming what Lebanon was into something entirely new, which is what the people are on the streets calling for.
President Macron chose an interesting date on which to make this visit. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is a date that's wrapped in history. Of course, after the First World War, our listeners will recall the Middle East was, and the former Ottoman Empire was carved up between two main powers, the allied victorious powers of France and the United Kingdom. France achieved the area of Syria and also control of Syria and also what would become Lebanon. And back 100 years ago, on September 1st, 1920, this is when Greater Lebanon was created, as it was known back then, which is basically the borders of Lebanon today. And the French, a French general, General Guron, he's the one that made this announcement that France was going to be in, not just in charge, but create this different state. And it was at the behest back then of a lot of the Christians that were in the area around Beirut. And back then, when the French were there coming in 1919 and 1920 to repel actually a bunch of Arabs that wanted to take over this land, those Lebanese Christians, as they would become, they were calling France their mother. The tender mother is coming to look after us, create a state for us, and that's what happened. And so here we are 100 years later. Of course, France didn't organize the timing of the Beirut attack for this, but it is interesting that 100 years later, all of this history is coming back up and people again are calling France, Lebanese people again, especially the Christians and the Sunnis, are calling France their tender mother that is going to help them through this difficult situation. And some of them even wanting more direct French rule. They're not saying they necessarily want colonial rule once again, mm-hmm. but they want the French to be very much involved at cleaning house in terms of the leadership in Lebanon.
Now, just before Macron visited, the Lebanese parliament announced they did have a new prime minister, a caretaker prime minister. An interesting choice that they made. They're certainly moving in, trying to distance themselves from the government that is so unpopular on the streets of Lebanon. But tell us about this new prime minister.
Yeah, so the difficulty is installing a caretaker prime minister that the people are going to see as a legitimate change from the former government. And so they've found somebody that isn't well known at all. He was the ambassador to Germany since 2013 through to right now. He was looking after Lebanese relations inside Germany. He has been tapped to be the caretaker prime minister that will see the transition towards elections over the next year. And this is a really interesting point, because in terms of biblical prophecy, we are, just as we will talk about in the second half, about this Psalm 83 alliance of moderate Arab states that come together in the latter times. We know that they are going to be allied with Europe, and particularly a German-led Europe as well. So we expect, although France is taking the lead in Lebanon's recovery and the transition in Lebanon, we expect more of a German flavor to come into those efforts and receive German backing, and perhaps even we see that with the caretaker prime minister having a lot of experience. 7 years in Berlin is quite a lot. He knows a lot of German politicians, and he can reach out to those to extend more European help inside Lebanon. Of course, biblical prophecy does, in this Psalm 83 alliance, put a German-led Europe with moderate Arab states, and Lebanon is going to fall in line in this alliance. And we expect then this German-led, French-involved push into Lebanon, intrusion into Lebanon, as the Iranians would see it, since this is a country that they have had control over for the past decade or so. We see that as really bringing together this Psalm 83 alliance in a very powerful way. That's why we're watching Lebanon and Europe's intervention there. And it seems that this blast is acting as the catalyst that we thought it would.
Well, this is the subject of our newest Trumpet edition. On the cover, "The Blast That Changed Lebanon." Brent wrote the cover story, "The Beirut Blast, Catalyst for Biblical Prophecy." Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, also has a short article called "Why We Told You to Watch Lebanon," pointing to some of the things that we have been saying, and he has been saying for 6 years or more. It's definitely something to keep your eye on. President Macron definitely tipped his hand right from the beginning and paid a visit to Beirut right after that happened. He's following up now. We're seeing this situation develop really exactly as we expected, and we will continue to watch that situation. Thank you very much for that, Brent. The recent poisoning of one of Vladimir Putin's strongest critics reminded us all of how merciless the Russian president can be. And it is putting pressure on Germany, particularly Germany's chancellor, to rethink a massive pipeline project that they've undertaken with Russia. For this story, we'll turn to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is having quite the impact in Germany. You may remember Jeremiah talked about this on an earlier show, that when this Putin opponent, Alexei Navalny, was poisoned, he was eventually taken to a hospital in Germany. And the German doctors are looking at him. They announced they believe he was poisoned by Novichok, which is a military poison developed by the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And this revelation has really caused a dramatic stir within German politics and even within German public opinion. One of the big geopolitical shifts of recent years is Germany moving closer to Russia. And the big symbol of this has been their Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And this is why this oil pipeline takes on enormous significance. This pipeline really does enable Russia. There's been a lot of anger about it within Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and within the United States. President Donald Trump has been very critical of it. What this pipeline does is it allows Vladimir Putin to cut off specific nations while still being able to sell oil to everybody else via Germany. In the past, it was much more of a blunt tool. If he cut off one nation, he was cutting off all the other nations that were downstream from them as well, and much less usable. So here you've got Germany really helping Vladimir Putin to increase in power quite substantially. And this has been something President Trump has drawn a lot of attention to. This is something that now the German press and German politicians are drawing a lot of attention to. So the head of the German Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, Norbert Rödinger, he said that the EU should jointly decide to stop Nord Stream 2. So Rödinger is a pretty senior figure in Angela Merkel's party. He is even considered a possible successor to Chancellor Merkel. And so he's saying, you know, we need to stop this. And then the Bild, Germany's best-selling newspaper, their equivalent, I guess, of something like The Sun or, I don't know, America doesn't really do newspapers in quite the same way. But anyway, they're saying that maybe Fox News would be the best American equivalent. They were really pushing for this pipeline to be cancelled, which to have something on that scale pushing for a pipeline cancellation shows you what a big deal this pipeline is. But they wrote that if Germany doesn't cancel the pipeline, it will be tantamount to us financing Putin's next Novichok attack. So a big shift within Germany. I mean, the German press have been scathingly critical of President Trump for what he's been saying about this pipeline. Mm-hmm. Now they're saying exactly the same thing.
What do you make of this, Richard? There are so many factors at play in German politics, and the fact that there's so much, say, Trump hatred, and that you see, the relationship with Iran and other things, the realization that NATO is defunct, where they actually are agreeing with him. Here's another instance of that. But this Nord Stream pipeline is so important strategically that you could see where Angela Merkel and German leaders would be very reticent to just put a stop to it. They've been really trying to push for it in spite of Donald Trump's efforts to shut it down. They're in between a rock and a hard place here, in a sense.
Right. They pushed for it despite Brussels as well. And the European Union really trying to force them to stop it. And they've shown who's really in charge of Europe by relatively easily seeing that threat off. I think the key to maybe understanding what will happen next comes from an observation that Mr. Flurry made in his cover article on this subject. He had a big article on this Nord Stream 2 pipeline called Germany's Secret War Against America. But in that article, he pointed out that Gerhard Schröder, who is Angela Merkel's predecessor, he signed the Nord Stream agreement originally back in 2005, after he'd been voted out of office, but before he'd officially left the job. So traditionally in that position, it's kind of, I mean, I guess it's not law, but maybe you could say etiquette, that the outgoing chancellor doesn't make any big decisions because he doesn't have a democratic mandate anymore. He's on his way out. There's a new person that's going to take office in a matter of days. But with the Nord Stream pipeline, this didn't happen. It wasn't a democratic decision. It wasn't put in place because of the will of the German people. And Mr. Flurry in that article wrote, this is an ugly thing for a politician to do. He knew the people had already voted him out, yet he decided to set this project in motion. This indicates what is happening with this German-led European power. It is being hijacked by leaders who don't always act in their people's interest. These leaders don't like America and want to befriend Russia. Apparently, they respect the authoritarian way Russia accomplishes its goals. So in the long run, I don't think they're going to be put off by this rise of German public opinion. Now, what Ms. Merkel does, you know, I don't know. I don't necessarily think she's maybe one of those Schröder-like politicians that knows that she wants and is going to do it regardless of what the people say. She has made big U-turns in the past to public opinion, most especially on nuclear power, for example, where she just shut down Germany's nuclear industry almost overnight, or at least its nuclear power plants. So I suspect she will keep going, but even if she doesn't, I don't think Germany is going to give up on this pipeline in the long term. And really, it's nearly finished. So even if Ms. Merkel were to say, okay, we're going to stop this, it wouldn't take much for a future German leader to come out and do the last few percent of that pipeline that is left to be laid. And remember, this is Nord Stream 2. Nord Stream 1 is already done, that first part that kind of got going with Chancellor Schröder. So I think what we could be about to see, it may well expose more of that undemocratic push and that real will behind this partnership with Russia.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense. If this goes through, obviously we will know. And the fact that it's being done in spite of this kind of public criticism and just the mounting evidence of what kind of a partner they have in Vladimir Putin, the fact that they would proceed anyway tells you a lot about the state of Germany today and the determination of German leaders to make sure that this partnership takes place. And if you could just give a brief idea, and it is in that article from Gerald Fleury about Germany and Russia's secret war against America, why the alignment between these two countries is so problematic.
Right, it gets to exactly what you were talking about. It exposes a lot about modern Germany, if they're so willing to go to this length. And Mr. Fleury in that article really focused on the way that Nord Stream 2 binds Germany and Russia together, and it undermines NATO. And he writes that many elite Germans feel their nation has now gotten all they can from the U.S. and they're ready to move on. Some powerful Germans today are thinking more and more about the Holy Roman Empire, and they want modern Germany to assume more power of its own in the spirit of that empire. They want to establish Europe as a mighty German-led superpower. And they talked about how, he talks about how Germany got a lot of support from America and NATO initially, but now they feel that NATO is holding them back, and they're quite ready to undermine it. He says that Germany is taking a risk with a dangerous dictator. You know, they know that. I don't think any of these leaders are under any illusions there. But this deal will boost more than just Russia's power and leverage, or maybe they are engaging in some wishful thinking. But anyway, this deal will boost more than Russia's power and leverage. It will also boost Germany. Germany has much to gain from this, and it will happen in a way that hurts many other nations. So there's a lot of Bible prophecies that talk about God using Germany to correct Britain and America. You know, Isaiah chapter 10 is probably one of the most specific that talks about God using Assyria, which in Bible prophecy is modern-day Germany, as the rod of his anger, what he uses to correct. And that prophecy, you know, that you had something along similar lines happen in the time of King Hezekiah when Assyria attacked Israel and Judah. But you can read Isaiah 10 and see quite clearly that that whole chapter was not fulfilled back in the time of Hezekiah. It's a future prophecy. And so while if Germany is going to turn against America, be used to punish America, they're going to have to break out of it. They will be breaking out of this NATO, American-led alliance. They'll be switching sides. And that's exactly what you see on display with this pipeline deal. And Germany is looking at an alliance with Russia as a way for them to be able to bring down America's dominance and to target America. So that article, like we mentioned, is a great place to go to learn more about this, to learn more in general about the role of Germany in Bible prophecy. We have a free booklet, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, that talks about this role that God has prophesied Germany will play, and even goes through and shows exactly how and why modern Germany is biblical Assyria. So that's a place you can get some more background on Germany and the Holy Roman Empire.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. President Putin is also closely watching events in Belarus, a former Soviet satellite nation that is exploding in unrest right now. Analysts are saying we need to watch the situation closely because Putin is very likely to use the instability there to pounce and expand his own power in Belarus. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, we've spoken on several recent Trumpet Hour episodes about the presidential election that took place in Belarus early last month, and about just how obvious it was that Alexander Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, rigged that election to, you know, give himself another term on top of the 26 years that he's already been in power. And, you know, we've discussed just how furious many of the people of Belarus were over this shameful just charade of democracy. Hundreds of thousands protested against Lukashenko in the aftermath of that. And now Lukashenko is heading to Moscow for a big meeting with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. This meeting's supposed to take place this coming Thursday, September 10th, and there's a lot of speculation that it could yield some momentous outcomes. The Institute for the Study of War wrote about this this meeting a couple of days ago, and they said it could culminate in Lukashenko ceding more of Belarus's remaining sovereignty to Russia. So this analysis talks about just how extremely vulnerable Lukashenko is right now, and about how well-positioned Russia is to exploit that vulnerability. It talks about the likelihood that Putin will be able to force Lukashenko to sign the Union State Roadmap. That's the agreement that Lukashenko refused to sign last year, which would essentially merge Russia and Belarus into one nation. And it also talks about the chance that this instability gives Putin specifically to deepen the Russian military's footprint in Belarus. It could open up some channels for him to place some additional basing there in exchange for, you know, just helping to keep Lukashenko in power. So this meeting really could be a landmark and just a major opportunity for Putin to bring Belarus more formally and more tightly under Russia's control.
Talk about Putin's ambition to do this and how this has been manifested. For quite a while, he's talked about this, and Belarus really is part of a larger strategy that he has.
It is, for sure, because Belarus, it's important to know that this was part of the Soviet Union. It was one of those 14 republics that were all merged into one superpower under the Kremlin, you know. And 15 years ago, Putin said that the collapse of that Soviet Union was the 20th century's greatest geopolitical catastrophe. And in the 15 years since then, Putin has really been doing what he can to reverse that catastrophe and to bring as much of the old geography of the USSR back under Moscow's power as possible. That's really what the invasion of Georgia was about in 2008. That's what the situation with Ukraine was largely about in 2014. In both of those former Soviet nations, Putin brought parts of them back under Russia's power, just like the entirety of those nations had been during the Soviet days. And then as for Belarus, it's already largely under Russian control. You know, the two militaries are integrated in some significant ways. They're bound together in the Collective Security Treaty Organization and also in the Eurasian Economic Union. So Belarus is, it's already more closely aligned with Russia than any other nation. But with this just very desperate situation that Lukashenko is in, and with this meeting that's coming up between him and Putin, it could give Russia a big opportunity to make its power over Belarus that much greater.
Well, we do have an article on the website Soviet Reunion, Russia and Belarus Push Toward Common State, that shows why this is so important, how much this tells you about Vladimir Putin and the rule that he has over Russia. We also have a booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, really, that you can read to learn more about both of the stories that we just talked about, just how much influence Vladimir Putin has and why that's important prophetically. We thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. America's election is less than 2 months away, and with the nation facing serious challenges and problems right now, the Democrats are turning to a very peculiar message in trying to defeat Donald Trump. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it's actually been a pretty low-key election campaign so far in terms of what the Democratic presidential candidate, Joe Biden, has actually said. There's been no debate between him and President Trump. Many figures are saying there will be no debate between him and
President
Trump.
I think they
President
have a few
Trump,
of them scheduled anyway.
Are they gonna go?
It'll be interesting.
I'm hoping. I'm really hoping. But it's. I know. Nancy Pelosi was pushing this week that he, Joe Biden, shouldn't dignify Donald Trump with a debate.
Right.
Well, I could think of a few other reasons why they might not want them to speak in front of people together. But
it sounds like Joe Biden's ready to go at it.
But well, he did. He definitely did get a chance to go at it this Monday. He not with President Trump directly, obviously, but he made one of his rare ventures out of the basement and gave a speech in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that was going well for or at least as well as you'd expect for him for a little bit, where he's made some nice comments about national unity. And even crossed the proverbial Rubicon River and condemned the protest. That's something that he'd been pretty quiet about for a while. Coming out and he said that rioting is not protesting, looting is not protesting, setting fires is not protesting, none of this is protesting. It's lawlessness, plain and simple, and those who do it should be prosecuted. So that seemed like good progress for him for a while. But then he, like I said, he took a strange election strategy and tried to, like, completely flip the script and blame all the protesting on President Trump's lack of commitment to law and order, where he said that President Trump can't stop the violence because for years he's fomented it. He's not been part of the solution thus far. He's part of the problem. And then even pointing out that this year that murder is up 26% under President Trump, as he phrased it. And I believe that statistic is correct. A murder at least in the big cities, in a lot of big cities, is up 26%.
Yeah, they really do want to pin this on Donald Trump.
Yeah, but they're trying to pin it on President Trump, and there's two big holes with that argument. The first one being that, like, okay, well, if you look where the rioting is happening, it's all predominantly liberal Democrat controlled cities. The rioters are all far left rioters. There's been a few conservative vigilante groups that have shown up after the riots to try to fight against them, but I think everyone realizes that these are primarily far left rioters in Democratic controlled cities, and so you can't
in cities where you often have mayors that are refusing federal intervention.
Right, that's the second point. Like I said, the first big hole in his argument is that, like, mm-hmm. well, it's the liberals that are doing the rioting, and the second one is that, like, well, he says these rioters should be prosecuted, but I mean, President Trump's been trying to do that from the very get-go.
Yeah,
and have had the Democrat mayors of these cities refusing to let any federal prosecutors into the city.
Mm-hmm.
So his hand is literally been tied by the Democratic officials in here. Now, if I was President Trump, I actually would take Biden's comments as a little bit of encouragement. In that, I don't know if you've ever gotten in an argument with someone who's kind of emotionally immature and won it, you'll realize that that's usually their last ditched effort. Is to flip the script at the last minute and try to figure, like, well, if you won the argument, then I need to take your position if I'm going to say face.
Right.
It's like blame shifting. And so it seems like that's what's happened here, is that for all summer, I mean, Biden's been kind of quiet, but like the Democrats have been talking about how racist the police are and how just the protesters are, both Barack Obama and Biden's running mate, Kamala Harris, have supported the protesters earlier in the summer. So we spent most of the year supporting these protesters and defaming the police.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, getting close to election, you're finding out that the majority of the American people kind of like President Trump's law and order message.
Mm-hmm.
So he's winning the argument. And so, like, last minute, like, well, I better start at least paying some lip service to law and order if I'm going to have any chance in
right.
this election.
There are a lot of people who are looking at signs like this as real warning signs that the Democrats are in trouble regarding this upcoming election. Of course, we're hearing more and more. We'll even talk in the second half about evidence that they're going to try to find some way to win it, even if their candidate loses. But this sort of chameleon-like approach to saying whatever is expedient at the time to try to win people over to their side, that really is characteristic of the movement in general.
Right, and that is something we definitely seen throughout these riots. Back in August, when the George Floyd riots were really just coming to their climax, our editor-in-chief published an article in The Trumpet titled "Race Riots Were Prophesied." And one of the subheads in that article is called "Speaking Like a Dragon," and he's explaining how a lot of these politicians speak, and he makes an allusion to a descriptive phrase in Revelation 13 about a religious leader who looks like a lamb but speaks like a dragon, and saying that kind of just that principle does describe a lot of these Democrat leaders and how they talk about race, even with like Joe Biden saying, hey, do I look, he said in that speech, do I look like a Antifa supporting radical who's who hates the police or something to that effect. And so, yeah, he's definitely trying to look like a lamb who wants peace and supports law and order. But when you just read between, even reading between the lines of what he's saying, just shows how much destruction his speech is causing. Because even when you get down there, he says that, like, oh, well, murder's up 26% because of President Trump. Now, we read between lines, like, all right, well, I guess that means if we want murder to go down, we have to do anything possible to get rid of President Trump.
Right.
Which is why murder's up 26% in the first place.
Right. Yeah. For them to basically, in some ways, it's kind of giving the protesters, the rioters, the violent people on the street cover. Like, well, what choice do they have? They're blaming what they're doing, not on them. And that's very much the law and order message. They're blaming what they're doing on the president.
Right. And then so if they blame it on the president, and then so they try to create this circumstance where they can riot more and more and more, and it just makes President Trump look worse and worse and worse. And then he suggests that he's going to send in federal troops or federal agents, and they say, well, like, okay, well, that's why we're rioting now, is because we're protesting against the agents. And it just gets in this negative, yeah, this negative feedback loop.
You know, we do have we will put that article from Gerald Flory up on the website, Race Riots Were Prophesied. I also really encourage you to read Brad McDonald's Trumpet Brief from yesterday about the cycle of hate that the United States is finding itself in right now. And it's talking about just how much anger and hatred there is in America, and how it opens the door for Satan's influence on our politics, on our society, and just how dangerous that is. That article is up on the website right now. Go check that out and look at the show notes, and we'll put it there as well. Thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
China continues its impressive march forward militarily and in other ways. Just how powerful is China growing? A new Pentagon report released this week revealed some stunning details. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, back in 2017, around the same time that Xi Jinping was working things out to let him rule China potentially for as long as he lives, he also set out two main goals for China's military, the People's Liberation Army. One was to complete modernization by the year 2035, and the other was to become a world-class military by 2049, which will be the 100-year anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. And this week, the U.S. Defense Department released its annual report to Congress about China's military power. It's a 200-page unclassified document that summarizes, you know, just a very wide range of findings. And the general assessment is that Xi Jinping is very quickly achieving those goals that he laid out a few years ago, and that the firepower of the PLA is very quickly increasing, and that China is basically on the fast track right now to become a global superpower.
It talks specifically about nuclear developments in China that were particularly concerning.
That was a big part of this report. Yes, right now China has an estimated 200 nuclear warheads, according to this Pentagon report, but it is in the process of doubling that number. So within a few years, they'll have 400. And the report notes that the nuclear buildup involves, quote, new processes, new tools, and new capacities. So this is not just the end product itself. It's about putting in place the entire infrastructure to do so, end quote. So it's, you know, they're really developing these processes and tools that could be used to soar far above that 400 number very easily and very quickly, and also processes that are about being able to deliver all of those nuclear payloads. You know, China has been in overdrive, especially developing various types of missiles that can send these nuclear warheads to their targets, whatever they may be. And of course, they can also deliver conventional warheads. But the report counts more than 1,250 ground-launched ballistic and cruise missiles that are now in the Chinese arsenal. And some of these, such as the DF-26, have ranges up to 4,000 miles. So just, you know, just obscenely powerful missiles. And the report says there are about 200 of those DF-26s now. And then there's also been a rapid development of launchers. Just a year ago, the Pentagon thought that China had only 80 mobile intermediate range ballistic missile launchers. That number is now up to 200. So when you put the picture of the nuclear warhead increase alongside the growing number of missiles and launchers, it really just shows that some of the most technologically advanced parts of China's military modernization drive are happening at lightning speed.
Another subject that they covered quite a bit was something that we talk about a lot on this program, that China is making a lot of advancement in its overseas bases. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a very big component of the PLA's modernization drive. They want to be able to deploy and support troops at locations around the world. We know that China already has an overt military base in Djibouti there in Africa. And this new report says that they're working on building bases in a long list of other nations. It discusses Angola, Indonesia, Kenya, Myanmar, Pakistan, the Seychelles, Singapore, Sri Lanka, Tajikistan, Tanzania, Thailand, and the United Arab Emirates. So in some of these places, you know, progress is not going as quickly as China may like, but in other places, it's making very fast progress. And so even though its activities right now appear to be civilian in most of these locations, this Pentagon report says that it really wouldn't take much for China to kind of flip the switch and turn some of these installations into military facilities that could support that future PLA footprint. So it's, you know, just a really significant development and one that we need to keep a close eye on.
Also, China has been really improving in its presence on the seas and its navy.
For sure. Yeah, that's actually the rising star of China's military right now is its navy. This new report brings out that the Chinese navy is now the largest in the world if you go by number of hulls. So when you add up all of their ships and all their submarines, the number now comes to 350. And that's far more than the U.S.'s fleet, which at present has 293 hulls. So, you know, the number of hulls, of course, is not always an apples-to-apples comparison. Mm-hmm. And many of China's vessels are still considerably less capable than some of America's. But that's no longer the case across the board. You know, China now has 130 major surface warships. It has two aircraft carriers and another that'll be online in 3 years. And it'll soon have between 65 and 70 submarines. And then in terms of shipbuilding, this report brings out that China has already surpassed America. So their capacity to bring more online is already above ours. So that means we should just expect this gap to keep on widening unless some major changes are made.
Now, to look at the way that China is conducting itself militarily and putting in context of the kinds of tensions that are continually building between America and China, and in context of how rapidly China is advancing economically and just in power projection in many ways in the world, it really shows that they have some muscle that should be of real concern to America, especially when you looked at in light of Bible prophecy and where China may put this to use.
Yes, and Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has been calling attention to all of that that you just mentioned in some really powerful articles. One of those was from 2016. It was called China is Steering the World Toward War, and he really emphasized especially its rising naval might. And then just in last month's edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet, he wrote another one called Where is the China-America Clash Leading? And he focuses a lot on what this Pentagon report has just brought out, especially China's activity in its littoral waters right around its own, you know, its own coast there, and especially its takeover of the South China Sea. And Mr. Fleury looks at it all through the lens of Bible prophecy. He especially focuses on a prophecy in Deuteronomy 28:52. That one's about the U.S. losing sea gates and shipping lanes that it once had control over. And so with China's military becoming so powerful and its navy especially becoming so powerful, as is brought out in this new Pentagon report, we really see this prophecy happening, because America had kept that region open to world trade pretty much since the end of World War II. But now China's moving in, it's becoming, you know, more and more in control of the area. And so I would just encourage anyone who hasn't to read Mr. Fleury's article, because it shows that all of this shifting power balance is fulfilling that prophecy in the book of Deuteronomy.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. After the peace deal forged recently between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, businesses immediately got to work reaping the economic rewards of normalized relations. We're going to learn about a couple of historic firsts this week from Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, a couple of firsts relating to airline flights from Israel direct to Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. This, of course, relates to the peace deal that was worked out between Israel and the UAE going back 2.5 weeks ago now. And on Monday morning, the first commercial flight took place from Ben Gurion direct through to Abu Dhabi. I think it took about 4 hours. It could have taken 7 hours. That is if the second first didn't take place, and that is that the Saudi Arabians allowed an Israeli jet to fly over their airspace or through their airspace over their territory, which cut the flight down from 7 hours to 4. So while Saudi Arabia hasn't said that they are going to have a peace arrangement with Israel similar to what the UAE have conducted, the fact that they have allowed Israel to fly through their airspace on commercial jets, and they said that they're going to do this from now on. Bahrain also came out today and said that they're going to do this from now on as well. It shows that
Bahrain is going to normalize relations, or they're going to allow
They're going to allow Israel to fly through their airspace. Bahrain's a small country, so it's not a huge deal.
Right.
But it would cut off an extra 20 minutes, I guess, from the flight as well. So this is going to make travel between Israel and the Gulf a whole lot easier. If you wanted to travel from Israel, let's say to Asia, most of the flights would have to, or all the flights would have to then go to Jordan first or to Turkey first. You couldn't fly direct to Dubai or Abu Dhabi. And Dubai itself is Abu Dhabi are really massive hubs coming from Europe or Israel through to the east, through down to Australia. And so this is opening up a whole lot more flights for Israelis, for Jews, and also opening up the east to Israeli airlines a whole lot more. And it's pretty significant. It's a very significant change. And the fact that Saudi Arabia is allowing it to fly through their airspace shows that Saudi Arabia does give tacit support to the peace deal between the UAE and Israel. Saudi Arabia, of course, is the big brother to the UAE. While they might not come out tomorrow and say that, yes, we're going to allow Israelis to fly into Riyadh or a normalization there, it shows that they're for this. They are happy with this arrangement between Israel and their Gulf little brother.
Israel is excited. There's a lot of high-flown praise for this development and a new era of peace that it promises in the region. You wrote an article in the latest Trumpet edition about that historic deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. And when you understand biblical prophecy, as you explained in that article, it tempers the enthusiasm a bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, whenever somebody is trying to reach out in some type of peace arrangement, that is worthy of praise, for sure. And it does seem that the leaders of the UAE and Israel, for now, they have a lot in common. And most importantly, the fact that Iran is right next door, and Iran is dangerous to both states, and they both need each other to form the security partnership against what the Iranians are doing. But you can't help but see the excitement of a lot of Israelis. Israel is bitterly divided right now. Mm-hmm. And to have this peace deal go down amidst that division, it really did allow Israelis to come together for at least a few days or a few weeks and recognize, at least they would see it, that they are getting accepted in the region. Now, in terms of Bible prophecy, when looking at this deal through that, we know that in the end, Israel is going to face a great attack, really, from not Iran and not Iran's proxies, but actually these the Gulf states, the very states that Israel has closer ties with right now and a security relationship with them right now. It wouldn't be surprising going forward that the Gulf states are going to have almost equal military sophistication that the Israelis have, just because of these other weapons deals that are being worked out on the sides of this deal with the United States. And Israel probably doesn't like that, but they see them right now as a friend and ally, and that those weapons won't be turned on them. However, looking into the Bible, Psalm chapter 83, it shows that these Gulf states, which form the biblical Ishmaelites, that's where Ishmael went, and in that prophecy in Psalm 83 of an alliance that comes together to fight against Israel, the Ishmaelites are mentioned. And so we know that in the end, this peace deal isn't going to last long. In fact, it will lead Israel into a false sense of security in terms of its relationship with other nations in the region, something that prophecy speaks about that would take place as well.
Well, definitely take a look at Brent's article in the October edition of The Trumpet. That's the latest. It's up on the website right now. Why the Arabs Embraced the Jews, and it will give you a very comprehensive look at the prophecy that he was just describing and putting this in its prophetic context. Thank you very much for that, Brent. More news about the coming American election. There's a lot of concern that this election will not be free and fair, that it will be manipulated or even stolen. We'll look here at some steps that big tech companies are taking to try to put their thumb on the scales to undermine Donald Trump. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
The search engine Google's been under heavy scrutiny this year for bias in its algorithms. There's been a couple different sources this week that noted kind of a strange phenomenon that if you type in BLM is into Google search engine, the auto suggest comes up as BLM Israel. Now, BLM is the well-known acronym for Black Lives Matter. And so if you just type in BLM is, it just goes to Israel. If you type BLM is space, you get no auto suggestion. If you back up and actually spell it out and go like Black Lives Matter is, the auto suggestion is Black Lives Matter is a revolutionary peace movement. Now, if you go to Yahoo and type in Black Lives Matter is, the first four suggestions are Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization, Black Lives Matter is racist, Black Lives Matter is Marxist, and Black Lives Matter is a hate group. And so it's really clear that Google is worked its algorithm to do everything it can so people don't find out Black Lives Matter's Marxist ties, its terrorist ties, its hate ties. And that's something that they've, like I said, they've been under heavy scrutiny before. Earlier this year, one of the experts on this topic, Dr. Robert Epstein, actually gave testimony before Congress saying that Google was deliberately biasing its algorithms and biasing its search results and biasing its basically anything you can find on there to shift the election to the Democrats. In his estimation, he thinks that there's going to be about 15 million people who vote for Joe Biden this election who would have otherwise voted for Donald Trump if they were getting their information from an unbiased source, from a source that, like I said, if you type in what is Black Lives Matter, it comes up with a revolutionary peace movement. And so this is something that, I mean, Google's been doing for years. Project Veritas actually caught a pretty high-ranking Google executive on one of their hidden cameras saying the same thing, that they said that they're just outright said that we're deliberately changing our algorithms to make sure Donald Trump does not get reelected.
Mm-hmm. Well, where would you send people for just information about why this is important, prophetically speaking?
Right. Well, one of the articles we will have in the show notes is actually something I'd written entitled "The Obama Media Empire Strikes Back," and it goes through actually television networks, Silicon Valley networks, looking at all the people who work for in Silicon Valley, who work for Google, who work for CNN, who are actually former Obama administration members. And the attempts by these members to basically act like a node of the deep state and change people's perceptions of reality. And then in there, even towards the end of that article, I quote our editor-in-chief and some of the comments he made about Daniel 8:12 being a dual prophecy. Daniel 8:12 is a prophecy about an Antiochus figure who casts down the truth to the ground. Now, of course, anciently, there was an Antiochus figure who tried to cast down the principles of the Jewish religion and destroy that religion. And then in the end time, there were two figures, one in God's church and one in the nation, that try to cast down the truth to the ground. And it puts that in context of basically what Google's helping the former Obama administration officials do, cast down Judeo-Christian moral values, constitutional principles of government to the ground, and make it so people don't even find out about them and change their perception of reality.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. We'll link to that article in the show notes. And speaking of Netflix, one of those big media companies that has wedded itself to the those Obama administration officials, it has another pretty landmark deal that it made this week. Our final story, we'll talk about this. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Prince Harry and his wife have signed a deal to make content with Netflix. It's speculated to be worth millions. So this couple that moved away from the UK, away from and to California to get out of the media spotlight and to you know, have less attention on them, they will now be making a series of movies, documentaries, children's content to Netflix. Very similar to the deal that Mr. Obama and his wife made with Netflix some years ago. They say they want to create impactful content that unlocks action. Now, we want to get a picture of what that content will look like. You just need to go back a couple of months, and you could see the Duke of Sussex giving a speech where saying that racism is endemic into Britain. He joined Black Lives Matter activists and some pretty far left individuals to talk about, you know, the shame in Britain's history and righting the wrongs and institutional and systemic racism that was that's present not just in the British Empire but in the British Commonwealth, the voluntary organization that succeeded it. So you're going to have them putting out probably some pretty far left extreme content similar to what Mr. Obama is putting out now. You know, the Bible talks about a royal family being used as a lamp, as a light. You know, God made a promise to King David that his family, one of his descendants, would always sit on a throne ruling over the tribes of Israel. And we've talked about how that applies, that the modern royal family in Britain are descendants of King David. And God talks about that repeatedly in the Bible, that throne as being a lamp to shine light on this world. Now what you see is an heir of this family going out and talking about how evil Britain's history is. And he'll presumably be doing that with Netflix, you know, attacking Britain and America's history, which really is an attack on Britain and America's connection with God and an attack on Bible prophecy. So it could be a big development. And it's something we have a free book, The New Throne of David. It's something that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has talked a lot about. In that book, he forecast several years ago that Britain's royal family would soon be going into a steep decline. We're seeing that already. And he said he talks about a major change that God is making to that throne in that book. And I think when you see the way that Prince Harry is behaving now, you really get a clear picture of why God had to make a major change in how he uses that throne. So that book, A New Throne of David, is a great place to go to really understand this critical Bible promise and then all the hope and light that it contains.
All right. Thank you, Richard. That will do it for today's program. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of C.S. Lewis. A proud man is always looking down on things and people. And of course, as long as you are looking down, you cannot see something that is above you. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.